We are still in the big section about symmetries in group theory. I hope you understood the basic idea of what we are trying to achieve. In the first step, we discussed the structure of important groups, in particular the Lorentz and Poincaré group, the other groups which are important. We'll have an example today. But usually the Poincaré group is essential for all theories, all relativistic theories. And then in the second step, we found representations of this group, one component, two component, four component. In principle, we could go on. And these representations are then the building blocks of our equations of motion, or for example, when you later will do quantum field theory, you don't construct equations of motion, but a Lagrangian, but the principle is the same. And now that we have these building blocks, so just to remind you, we had phi, which was a scalar field, one component. We had two component objects. We called them phi L and phi R. And we have A mu, the four potential from electrodynamics, which has four components. And when you think about equations of motions, in addition to the fields or wave functions, you have usually, or actually in all cases in physics, you have derivatives, d mu, and sometimes or quite often you have constants, numbers. We had, for example, the mass, which is very common, or also matrices like the gamma matrices we defined a couple of weeks ago, and so on. And now the most interesting step and the main message of this big section is, how can we combine these things to useful equations of motions and theories? And I think I wrote down three guidelines last time. First of all, the equations of motions need to be invariant under Poincaré transformations. This is essential for every relativistic theory. We had it already in relativistic quantum mechanics. Second, it should be a rather simple equation of motions. There's no deep reason I can give you here, or a simple explanation, but nature seems to be simple. All the equations you have learned so far are very simple equations. For example, they are linear differential equations. I mean, think about if your equations of motions would be nonlinear. You would have essentially no chance in solving them. By the way, not all physics equations are nonlinear. Maybe those of you who have heard general relativity know that they are nonlinear equations, so also QCD. But for example, Maxwell's theory, electrodynamics, also mechanics, where you started, quite often these equations are linear. If not linear, then at least simple, maybe quadratic or cubic or so, but no weird terms like power to the 16 or some kind of complicated function, logarithm of one of the building blocks. This is, as far as I remember, I've never seen such a thing. So the idea is, make sure you find something Lorentz invariant and try out the simplest possibilities. And a third point, which is related to the simplicity, is about the derivatives. Of course, it would be most simple to use no derivatives, but this gives no interesting physics laws. You need the derivatives. And also from experience and comparing to experiments, they either appear linearly or quadratic. Also here, I don't know any fundamental theory where the derivatives are not linear or quadratic. So these, I would say, are the guidelines. And when you obey these guidelines, the chance is very good that you find useful or sensible theory, and also quite large to find an equation which indeed describes nature. So basically, we will come to that in a little bit more detail today. You can construct the whole standard model or all forces of nature by following what I just said. Okay, last time we had the example of a one-component equation which gave us a Klein-Gordon equation. Maybe this was a bit difficult to understand because it was too simple or so. So now we are going on to something more complicated, but something you still know. Equation for our four-component object A mu. Now, if we do what I just said, we could try several things. For example, an equation with a linear derivative like d mu a mu equals 0. So this is probably the first thing which comes to mind. We could also use two different indices, d nu, a mu, but this is also probably not such a good idea because when we have two different indices, we have suddenly 16 equations. So this one would obviously be Lorentz invariant because there's a sum over the upper and lower index. It's simple, the derivative is appearing linear, but still it's not really a good thing. It turns out to be too simple. So when you solve it and when you compare to expectation or experiment or anything, you find there's not enough dynamics contained to describe reasonable physics. I mean, then the next step would be a quadratic derivative. So an A field and two times d mu. So what can we do? We have this thing here, and we need to assign three indices. Three different indices, again, is probably not a good idea because then we have 4 times 4 times 4 is, what, 64 equations. This is also a bit unusual. So probably we need to sum over one index. And yeah, what kind of possibilities do we have? We can sum in that way. Then we have here the D'Alembert operator acting on A. Or another possibility would be to do the following, sum over the A field and the derivative, and let's keep it consistent, assign the open index here, and set the whole thing to 0. So both things are fine when we go through the list. It both is a Lorentz invariant, as we showed, for example, last time also for the scalar field. The double index is anyway a Lorentz invariant thing. Here, when we do a Lorentz transformation with the open index, of course, we pick up a Lorentz transformation lambda, but it's not necessary that directly after Lorentz transformation the equation looks identical. It just must be equivalent to the equation looking identical. So we can multiply the whole thing with the inverse Lorentz transformation again, and everything looks in another inertial system then the same. Still, when you think about Maxwell's theory about Maxwell equations without any electrical charges, Maxwell equations in vacuum. You probably remember that this is still too simple. This is not the correct answer, and that is not the correct answer. Maybe you remember the correct answer. It's basically this thing and that thing combined with a plus. And there's also, I mean, in principle, we could now say, good, we have two candidates, and we need to play a little bit around and compare to experiment and then see that we need to add both. But there's a much deeper principle, which is also connected to symmetries in physics, which precisely gives you the result that you have to add these two things. And this is what I'm going to discuss now, and also something which you heard certainly in electrodynamics, but I guess where you didn't or could not understand how powerful or important it is, at least in my electrodynamics lecture. I mentioned it, we discussed gauge symmetry, Eichsymmetry auf Deutsch, but this was more a mathematical trick, but nothing needed to construct the theory. But yeah, now we use it in our context of group theory. So the idea is the following, not only for electrodynamics, for all our forces in nature. We have another restriction, which is called gauge symmetry. This is a very important word in physics. It's an incredibly powerful concept. It allows to construct all four fundamental forces. So what do we have? It's electrodynamics, it's the strong interactions, the weak interactions, and gravitation. We cannot discuss it in full beauty, but still I give you a certain outlook now. And it works like this. We would like to have the following. So like to have the condition for our equations of motion. Let's call it field equation of the electromagnetic interactions. Must be invariant with respect to a so-called U1 gauge symmetry. And this U1 gauge symmetry is the following, or is the following form, A mu of x equal g of x, A mu of x plus I over E d mu inverse of x. So this looks at first glance a bit weird. First of all, let me define g. G of x is e to the plus I alpha of x, and this is an element of U1. So U1, we discussed already, SU2. U stands for unitary, 1 stands for 1 by 1 matrix. So 1 by 1 matrix is a number, and a unitary number has a property that the number times the complex conjugate number is 1. So basically U1 means just a complex phase. And this is what you see here. Alpha is real, and exponential of I times alpha is a phase. And it's important to remember and to keep in mind that a gauge transformation is a local transformation. Local means it depends on space-time. So for any space-time point x, we can choose any U1 element, any phase we would like. And the gauge transformation is defined in that way here. That, I'll use maybe a different color. That the untransformed and the transformed gauge field are related in that way. And here, the prime should not be mixed up with a Poincaré transformation. The prime denotes the field after the transformation, but now we are not discussing about changing the inertial system. We are discussing this particular gauge symmetry. So, yeah, this denotes gauge trafo in this context. And what it says is that, yeah, basically when you do this transformation, replace a mu by a prime mu, then your equation of motion should be the same or must be the same. And yeah, again, it looks very weird, but taking precisely this definition, just replacing the A mu field, maybe by the gluon field or by the field of the weak interactions, or also in a very similar way by the metric when you do general relativity, this basically gives you, as I said, the four fundamental forces of nature. So even though it looks probably weird in the first place, it's an extremely powerful concept. And in my opinion, the most fascinating and beautiful thing in physics at all. I mean, probably when you see it for the first time, you shake your head and say, it's very strange. But think back, for example, about mechanics. Before you heard mechanics, when somebody told you there's a quantity called action, which you cannot measure, but when you find the extremum, you get the equation of motion. It's also very strange and weird, but now you're probably used to it, and you know that essentially any physics system can be described by action in a very elegant way. And also this gauge symmetry, or one also says gauge principle, when you request a half gauge invariance, is a very deep and very important principle. And this equation, which I put on the board, you know it in a simpler form from your electrodynamics lecture. I'm sure you discussed a gauge transformation in electrodynamics, right? And what you probably did is not use this very general thing, but your professor took this before he wrote anything on the board and inserted it in this equation here. And what do you have then? It's a prime mu of x equal e to the power of plus I alpha of x, a mu of x. And here, the inverse of g is just with a minus sign. And then when you do the derivative becomes what? It's I divided by e, and yeah, the exponential stays the same, and nachdifferenzieren gives a minus I and a d mu on alpha of x, and then e to the minus I alpha of x. And now you see the phases in this context here cancel, and this one here, the i's can be combined to a plus. You have plus 1 over e d mu alpha of x. And I think this thing here you probably saw in electrodynamics, right? It's much simpler to use. Only in electrodynamics, a gauge transformation has a simple form, because for the other three forces of nature, G is not a U1 element, but an element of a more complicated group. Then you cannot so easily compute the derivative or calculate the derivative. Therefore, in electrodynamics, it's more convenient to use this thing here. But I wanted to give you the more general thing, because in this line here, which is still correct, you don't see anything about U1 anymore, right? The U1 element is essentially gone. Only the alpha from the phase remains. So because we are discussing group theory and I want to already give you an outlook how important this is, I decided to have a more general, maybe a bit more lengthy equation showing the context to group theory. But after this line here, you should realize that actually you know this equation in a simpler but equivalent form from your electrodynamics lecture. Okay, so this is now the gauge principle, and coming back to our problem, we have two candidates for equations of motion, but now when you insert this line either to this equation or to that equation, you will find that it's not gauge invariant. When you insert the transformation, you see that you have a different equation of motion after the gauge transformation. And this violates the gauge principle. And there are only two combinations, two linear combinations of these two terms, which are in fact gauge invariant. And one is the following, gauge invariant combination of terms in 301. It's d mu a nu minus d nu a mu equal zero. So it's exactly the first term and the second, and I said it wrong 10 minutes ago. It's not a plus, it's a minus with which you can or have to combine it. And again, when you now transform this equation to the prime by inserting exactly this relation here, you'll find the same equation after the gauge transformation. So this is a valid thing. And I don't need some space here. What I've written down here, you should also remember from electrodynamics, namely, what is this? The field strength, exactly. And this is then the electric and the magnetic fields. This is not the only combination. There's one more combination, which also gives you an important equation you saw in electrodynamics, but this is on the current homework sheet, so I think it's good when you play a little bit around with the gauge theory thing. So, and I'm not going to do it here in the lecture, but I hope you got that gauge symmetry is another very important symmetry, which can be described by groups in our context by a very simple group, the group of complex phases U1, and that this symmetry constrains the possibilities, yeah, basically the only a single or two possibilities, but the other possibility, which I didn't discuss or write down, is equally important than set one here. Yeah, and maybe also as an outlook, it's not in the script, when you are interested in the strong interactions, maybe you haven't seen or heard anything in detail about the strong interactions, it's quarks and gluons. You can proceed exactly in the same way, 100% identical what we did here. Only thing you need to do is to replace U1 by a much more complicated group, SU3. SU3 are unitary 3x3 matrices with unit determinant. And SU3 is a 3x3 matrix, therefore your gluon field needs to be a 3-component vector or have another index running from 1 to 3, and this is the color of the quarks, red, green, and blue. And when you are interested, for example, in weak interactions, you have to replace U1 by SU2, and then you find basically the weak interactions as realized in nature. I put it in quotation marks. Maybe some of you have heard already quantum field theory, or those who will and remember this. Here it's really 100% identical and very simple. Here there are other complications you need to take into account, which we are not going to discuss here. And gravitation is also can be derived in a very similar thing. Here you replace U1 with arbitrary coordinate trafos, which is also maybe not 100% identical, but very, very similar, of course, more complicated. So I hope that with this brief outlook here, you understand that there's another very important internal local symmetry called gauge symmetry, which is important to derive or to understand the form of the equations of motion in nature. And so gauge symmetry is not just what you heard in electrodynamics, a trick maybe to simplify equation of motions by going to a specific gauge. It's a much deeper thing which constrains the equations of motions which are allowed. More details about this are probably given in quantum field theory. When you go to quantum field theory at some point, or you're interested in this, take a book about quantum field theory, and there, in particular, what I have on the board about U1, and typically the SU3 thing from the strong interactions is discussed also in very complete and long quantum field theory books. The weak interactions, which are a little bit more difficult, and once you have understood it, when you revisit general relativity or take a book about general relativity, you will also find strong similarities to what's here on the board about gauge theory. So, again, the main result is this one. At the beginning of the lecture, I had a list. I said Poincaré invariance, a simple equation of motion, linear and quadratic derivatives. And now, when we add gauge symmetry, then essentially we find this equation. And this equation is a very important one, the Maxwell equations in the vacuum. There's another thing which we can immediately understand, namely, you could say, prima, I have now an equation of motion, but now I'm interested to have massive gluons. And yeah, we know, for example, from the Dirac equation or from the Klein-Gordon equation, that typically adding a term m times the field adds a mass or gives a mass to the particle. So we could say, let's try the following. What about taking exactly what we found here and adding something? It's Poincaré invariant. It's simple. It has quadratic derivatives. But this one here is not gauge invariant. Also something you can easily check as a homework. Therefore, such a term is forbidden by the gauge principle. And yeah, this, in a certain sense, explains why our gauge bosons, why the carriers of force, the photon, the gluon, etc., why these are massless. Again, a consequence of the extremely important, even so abstract, gauge symmetry I wrote on the board. Okay, so I would say what we did now today is still very simple. Maxwell's equation in vacuum, for that we don't need the group theory things, or you derived in your third semester without such stuff. So we are interested in more complicated, in longer and more interesting equations of motion. And the next candidate we could discuss are equations for phi and a mu. So an equation where a scalar particle described by a wave function or field phi interacts with the electromagnetic field. And we had it already to some extent in the section about relativistic quantum mechanics. Remember, I told you, or we repeated, how to couple a charged particle to an electromagnetic field. It was this thing which we called, I think, minimal substitution, where the derivatives are replaced by the derivative plus or minus I times the four potential. So same thing we are, what can do here, the phi equation. See section 4, 3, 5. Replace I d mu by I d mu minus electrical charge times mu. And what you find then is the following: d mu plus I e a mu d mu plus I e a mu plus m square phi equals zero. And yeah, again, going through our list, it's in a very obvious way Poincaré invariant, because we sum over an upper and a lower index mu, and m is a scalar number, phi is a scalar, so it's Poincaré invariant. Derivatives appear quadratically, and it's simple. And the last thing, the gauge symmetry, this is also your homework, your task to check that it's gauge invariant. But believe me, when you insert this thing here, then you find that it's gauge invariant if, yeah, another thing we need to add or say here, equation is gauge invariant if we define phi prime of x is g of x phi of x. So what I gave you here was the behavior of the four potential under gauge transformation, and what I wrote down here is a behavior of a scalar wave function or field under gauge transformation. So you're not allowed to only use one and two belong together. So when you do a gauge transformation, you can decide for an element of the gauge group of U1, and then you need to transform your gauge field in that way, and at the same time your scalar field in that way. And again, when you plug in this one here and this one here and here, you'll find at the end that your equation is exactly the same in the prime coordinates. So this was half of it. We have an interacting theory of phi and a, so we need a phi equation. This is what we find here, what we basically understood already in relativistic quantum mechanics, where we now just checked that it fulfills all the criteria. And yeah, next thing, or second thing, is the a mu equation. And yeah, also here we could remember electrodynamics. Remember electrodynamics. There we had d mu f mu nu is some number times j nu. These are the Maxwell equations, not in the vacuum, but with electrical charges. The number for pi is convention. Maybe you've seen a different convention. So this was the thing, but j mu we don't want to have. We would like to have a fundamental theory only containing a and phi. So somehow we need to express the charge density and charge current j by the charge generated by the particles described by phi, either as a wave function or a field equation. And how do we do it for phi? When you think back about the section about relativistic quantum mechanics, we wrote down or derived a continuity equation and also a corresponding four current. And this is exactly what we insert here. Use four current of the wave function of the Klein-Gordon equation, was equation 196. Again, due to gauge symmetry, we need to do it. Otherwise, it's not gauge symmetric. Again, replacing I d mu by I d mu minus E a mu. Yeah, and then what do we have? It's d mu f mu nu equal 4 pi I epsilon. I epsilon was from the current we had in the section about relativistic quantum mechanics. And then more important thing, it was something like phi complex conjugate derivative of phi minus the opposite. And now, as we said above, we need to replace the ordinary derivative with this thing here because of gauge invariance. And now writing the opposite thing is just, need to pay attention with brackets now, the new there's a typo in the script. You need to add a bracket. Plus I E A nu phi star phi. Here we need to be careful because it's your homework. If you get it wrong from the board or from the script, you might have a lot of work and no success in your homework. Let me check it again. I think now it should be okay. Yeah, we have one more thing. So it looks lengthy and complicated, but again, it's not. We have taken something j mu, which we knew from the relativistic quantum mechanics section, which is a good candidate for four current. It's also not so surprising to replace the derivative by the derivative plus the gauge field, and this at the end will give gauge invariance. So as we said here, also here, this equation is gauge invariant using both equation number two and equation number one here. And then we have, fortunately, not too many colors, our final result here. Which is basically the series, the simple theory describes phi and a and an interaction between the two. As we discussed in relativistic quantum mechanics, you could now understand this equation here is a quantum mechanical equation where phi is a wave function, but this has certain shortcomings. Basically, what's now on the board is a more important equation for quantum field theory, where phi describes a charged scalar particle and A describes the ordinary photon field from electrodynamics. Okay, so I guess it's very complicated and very abstract because you have never seen it before. When you are used to it and saw it many times, it's not anymore so strange as it looks or might look now, but still think a bit back. Even so, if you didn't get all the arguments and steps, again, only by imposing Poincaré invariance, by taking the simplest possible combination, and by requesting gauge invariance, we found this rather complicated set of equations. I mean, probably, just one second, probably we could have done or derived it by maybe making electrodynamics experiments and playing around with a lot of equations. But now go, for example, to quantum chromodynamics. Quantum chromodynamics describes quarks and gluons. And you probably have heard that you can never observe isolated quarks. So there, comparing with experiment is suddenly much more complicated, because when you write down a theory about quarks and you can observe quarks only in pairs or in groups of three, it's very, very difficult to, you need to do complicated calculations within your theory before you can compare to nature. And also the more advanced theories, or when you extend something beyond what's called the standard model, when you do string theory, when you do any mathematical thing in physics which is not yet established experimentally, or where experiments are not able to contribute, this is, I would say, the only way to go forward. And without this thing here on the board, without the symmetries constraining equations of motions, particle physics and probably many other areas in physics wouldn't be where they are now, not nearly as far as they are now. So this is not just a technical thing I like very much and I use now here to make your day miserable or so. It's indeed the most fundamental thing in physics, symmetries and their applications. It's certainly a big step, and I guess you haven't seen this before, but when you want to become a good theoretician or also a good experimentalist understanding the theories, there's no way around it. On the other hand, I fully understand it's complicated. If you don't get everything today, I'm perfectly happy also with this, and don't worry, it takes time, but whenever you see it, try to understand a bit more and a bit more until you fully got it. So. The I is, I think, the only thing where this one, no, the phi and the I, there it has an effect. The derivative doesn't change and the A doesn't change. Of course, we can put the complex conjugate only on the phi, but then you need to write a minus here, and I preferred to do it in that way because then it's a bit more obvious, no confusion, just this same rule of replacing the derivative by this thing. So before, before there was a term only d nu phi, and you are now, I think I see your question now. You're asking, are we making the replacement here in this thing or insisting, is this what you are after?
So. Yeah. So I was a little bit confused that we normally would also have to take the complex conjugate, but it just didn't matter, so no one
did. Okay, so I mean the correct answer is this one here, and to understand why this is the correct answer, just try the opposite, basically, where you have a minus here and do what your homework task is, namely check whether the whole thing is gauge invariant or not. To be honest, it's a bit long ago and I didn't see this subtlety when I prepared the lecture yesterday, but I guess when you do the homework or when you check or play a little bit around with gauge invariants, you probably soon find that you always should do the replacement, which I wrote down here, for such expressions to get gauge invariant and not for SAS. Or in other words, when you have a derivative on a complex conjugate field, you could also say then use a plus here, which is probably the same thing. I mean, the main message remains in any case, find something which is gauge invariant, and there are not many options, but indeed you need to be a bit careful. Okay. Yeah, we are anyway far over half time. Let's do a 5 minutes break and continue at 11:15. Okay, so after the 5 minutes break, are there any questions or doubts which you might?
I have one. So we just saw that like these J of X that like defines the gauge transformation is element of the U1 group, right?
Yeah.
So does that mean that it has to satisfy the algebra as well?
Does it mean what?
Does it mean that it the generators of J of X need to satisfy the algebra?
The generators of G of X need to be what?
Satisfy, satisfy these commutation relations of the Lie algebra.
Yeah, but it's, we can do it as an exercise. U1 has a very simple algebra. So U1 are elements e to the power of I alpha. And what do we need to do for generators? We need to consider infinitesimal transformations. This is 1 plus I alpha. Alpha is then our infinitesimal parameter. I is there by convention. So how many generators do we have and how do they look like? There's one generator, and it is one, exactly. And that's it, and I mean the algebra of J, comma J is the only commutator we can compute, and what is this? Zero, yeah. So it's an example which is not good to illustrate Lie groups because it's too simple, you would be confused. Now that you have seen more complicated groups like rotations, you can formally do it like we did, but not much behind.
My confusion was because when we define the scalar field, when we were looking to the Lorentz groups, we also have a U1 matrix, but with the generators all equal zero, right? Like the boost generators, the rotation generators, and the translation generators were all zero. So that was why I was confused, but they also satisfy this algebra, so probably that might be the reason why both are called U1.
Now, cannot fully follow. I mean, this now on the left-hand side is the discussion of the gauge transformation and the corresponding group. When we have the Lorentz transformations in Lorentz group, then we have transformations phi prime equal, in a formal way, we had always I alpha j jj plus, I think it was eta j kj phi. And since a one-component scalar field does not change, here we have zeros, right? But it's not a U1 element.
It's,
I mean, this is it's just the identity here. So,
okay, so
and also the algebra is different. This one is. The outcome is even more simple because it's always one, but the algebra is not as simple as this one. This is a trivial algebra. Only one generator always commutes with itself. The Lorentz algebra is six generators, the three rotations and the three boosts, but the one-by-one representation is or must be very simple. You have to choose the number zero to fulfill the complicated algebra.
Exactly, but since you choose them to be zero, the commutators will also be zero.
The commutators are all. The commutators are all zero. Maybe this is also not the correct words you should use. It was, for example, one of them had set form here, and I would say the commutator is fulfilled when you put in zeros. The right-hand side is not just the number zero, it says jx and jy give I jz, and a solution to these defining commutators is taking zero, because commutator of zero and zero is zero, which is identical to zero when you insert zero on the right-hand side.
Yes.
And think about, now you're asking a question about difficult thing, and I come with an even more complicated example. Not sure whether it's pedagogically good, but think about doing the whole exercise for QCD. Then you wouldn't have a U1 gauge symmetry, but a SU3 gauge symmetry. You don't need to understand the mathematics now, but then it's maybe much clearer than that the Lorentz symmetry is very different from the gauge symmetry. And maybe go even a step farther. Don't take a scalar particle, but take a particle with spin. This is what I'm immediately going to start. Then we don't have C simple representation.
Yes.
Then we have whatever complicated set of generators mixing the spin components on the Lorentz transformation. And let's say with SU3 in QCD, we have a complicated behavior under gauge transformation, but they have nothing to do. I think what might confuse or what you are thinking or saying now is that this looks already very similar. Here we have a phase. Here we also have almost a phase, which is always one. We have commutators, which are in both cases zero. But still, the algebra is much different, and the concepts are completely independent. Gauge trafos and Lorentz trafos don't mix. You need separately Lorentz or Poincaré invariants and separately gauge invariants, and it's just maybe a consequence of the simplicity is that it looks a bit similar at the moment. As I mean, saying now that this is so simple, I'm feeling already a bit bad because it's probably not so simple when you see it for the first time. But as I told you before, when you, for example, do quantum field theory at the very end, you write down typically the Lagrangian of the standard model, and this is a the Lagrangian is similar to the equation of motion, and this is a equation going roughly over two pages. And I would say there you really need these symmetries to construct it or to understand it. I guess without them, not sure whether you would have the standard model. And when you go to other things, for example, supersymmetry, I had to do when I was a PhD student for a couple of weeks, and that's much more extreme. The most simple, or one of the simplest supersymmetric theories, when you open the book, the action or Lagrange function starts on page 7 and ends on page 11. And it's tremendously complicated when you look at it, but when you really understand it, it's not so complicated. It's just a mathematical consequence of finding and writing down all the terms constrained and necessary by the symmetries. And this is, I repeat myself many times, but I really want that you get it. This is the power of these symmetry things, that very simple conditions you impose at the beginning give at the end very lengthy and therefore seemingly complicated equations of motions. And simpler things are not allowed, therefore the formalism really allows you to construct these complicated equations in a comparably simple way when you master the techniques of group theory. So the final example we are doing, and then the whole section is done. It's the equation for phi L and also for phi R. And this will bring us at the end again to the Dirac equation. And I think this is a good example, because the Dirac equation, in my opinion, is a rather unnatural equation. I mean, we derived it by all these arguments. You would like to have a linear equation, and it must contain the Klein-Gordon equation and whatever. And we found some 4x4 matrix equation 4 weeks ago, but now, not today, but next week, we are going to derive it purely based on symmetries. And this I find very beautiful and gives a much better understanding of the Dirac equation. One comment to the homework, when you have already downloaded or looked at it, there are two exercises. The first one is about gauge symmetry, so you learned everything necessary. The second one is about what we are starting now but not finishing today. So we discussed a bit, and since you only can do it on Tuesday and you have to hand it in on Thursday, it's a rather short time. So we decided the second exercise is optional, so the 10 points awarded or assigned to this exercise is not part of the full set where you need to gain the 50%, but still you can hand it in and get the points. So in other words, I think we have how many sheets? 12 sheets are 20 points, so 240 points. 50% would be 120 points, and a few weeks ago we reduced already by 10 points because I forgot to upload it. We reduce it now by another 10 points, divided by 2 for the 50%, so the relevant threshold or so of points is 110, not 120. Still, I strongly recommend to do it. It's, I could have designed a simpler exercise, which you can do, but I wanted to keep it because what I just said, understanding the Dirac equation, is a very nice thing. Then in my opinion, or at least when I was a student, for the first time I understood why this whole thing might indeed be useful. Therefore, my suggestion is do it either from Tuesday to Thursday or do it later, so it doesn't matter. The points are not so relevant. They are just optional bonus points, but do it for yourself to understand these rather complicated things. Yeah, let's start with one of the two, with phi L. Let's do the first try, d mu phi L equals 0 linear derivative. It's, or you can easily show that it's Lorentz invariant. Of course, you pick up lambda 4 by 4 matrix acting on D, another 2 by 2 matrix according to the transformation law of phi L. But since there's no other term or nothing, you can multiply after the transformation with the inverse of these matrices, and then you have in the other inertial system exactly the same equation. So principle, it would be a valid equation, but it's still not a good equation. And this time, the reason is not that it's too simple because we have only a first derivative. The reason is a bit different this time. Remember that this one is a two-component object, phi L1, phi L2, and when we act with a derivative on it, it has a very simple structure. There are two equations then, d mu phi L1 equals 0 and d mu phi L2 equals 0. And these equations are completely independent and decoupled. And the thing why they are not good in our context is the following. These equations would be Lorentz invariant also if phi wouldn't transform in the complicated way which we derived. Just to remember, phi L prime is e to the I, usual thing, alpha j, 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 plus eta j, kj, phi L, and don't need to write it down in detail, but these are 2 by 2 matrices, roughly the Pauli matrices. So again, it is Lorentz invariant, and this one is also Lorentz invariant, and you don't need this line. You could formulate or write down the same equation for a scalar phi. If phi does not transform at all, for example, it's still Lorentz invariant. And this is also a rule or a guidance principle. Never use an object which has a complicated transformation law if you don't need that complicated transformation law. Then stay simple. So in other words, to get a useful or reasonable equation, we need to find something where this one is indeed necessary to have Poincaré invariance. Otherwise, we are generating a lot of work, and at the end, it won't give anything reasonable. So this is this long text block here, what I just said in simple words. Poincaré invariance does not require this one here, and the conclusion or thing to remember, write down only equations where you need, say, let's call it complicated. Transformation law. And here again, I mean set one. To get an equation where the transformation law is needed, it's probably helpful to first write down again in a very careful way how these things transform. Introduce also a bit of notation. Phi L is S L times phi L. It's nothing else than I wrote in the first line. I just introduce the notation SL. SL is basically the matrix defined by the exponential function. SL is e to the power of I alpha j jj plus eta j kj. And now remember or look back in your script for the left-handed Weyl spinor. We had here the Pauli matrix divided by 2. And here's the same with a plus or minus I. I don't remember myself, but when you insert it correctly, you find e to the power of plus I alpha j sigma j over 2 minus eta j sigma j over 2. And the other thing, the derivative, which we certainly also need under Lorentz transformation, transforms in that way here. Now, a statement, one can show the following. Lambda mu nu S L dagger sigma L mu S L equal sigma L nu with sigma L mu equal 1 minus sigma vector. Yeah, let's first understand all the symbols. Lambda is clear. It's the 4 by 4 standard Lorentz transformation. SL and SL dagger is defined here. It's a 2 by 2 matrix transforming the spinors. And then sigma L mu is defined here. Sigma L mu is, in a certain sense, a 4 vector, at least something looking like a 4 vector. It has 4 entries, but the entries are by themselves 2 by 2 matrices. In the 0 component, it's a 2 by 2 identity. In the 3 components are minus the 3 Pauli matrices. So this is basically a 2 by 2 matrix equation with an additional index running from 0 to 4. So 2 by 2 matrix equations are 4 equations times 4. You have 16 equations on the board. And you can show that this is the case. For example, you can now insert what's defined and check the validity as a homework. Now you could, of course, ask what if we wouldn't have known it or if I wouldn't have written it on the board. I think when you go much deeper in group theories than we did, there are also ways to, in a straightforward way, to derive this thing. But I cannot do it on the board now or so. I also would have to look it up. Still, it's not too complicated, the equation or the statement here. And for the moment, I suggest you just believe that it's true, or you check it at home if you don't believe it. In any case, this is an important line which now allows us to write down a much better equation of motion or wave equations in here, namely the following: thus, sigma L mu d mu phi L equals 0 is invariant under Poincaré trafos, because now we use this thing here, sigma L mu d mu prime phi L prime equals 0. This is an equation which I claim is a good one in another inertial system, in the primed inertial system. Now I can replace the primed by unprimed quantities. This gives us sigma L mu lambda mu nu d nu SL phi L equals 0. So I inserted this one and that one here and here. Then in the next step, I think I don't do much. I can do it with another color on the board. I can just multiply with another matrix from the left-hand side, because on the right-hand side is a 0, so it's still true. I multiply with SL dagger. And after doing this, or I did this, to find this helper equation here. We have here, and here, exactly what we have in this equation. Lambda mu nu SL dagger sigma L mu SL. Not perfect in the correct order, but lambda mu nu is just a number. It's not a matrix because it's written in indices, so you can exchange lambda with anything you would like to have, and then you are exactly where what you have here. So the consequence is we can replace the complicated stuff just by sigma L nu, and then we have sigma L nu d nu phi L equals 0. And can also make the arrow in both directions. So we have exactly shown that this is a Poincaré invariant equation. And again, the major difference now compared to those equations here is that we need both the complicated transformation law for d mu and for the two components of phi L. This is contained in this relation here above. Only when phi transforms and when d mu transforms, the whole equation is Poincaré invariant, but not in such a trivial way as here. So this indeed is a valid and good equation to describe two-component spinors, and it reminds, in my opinion, already strongly to the Dirac equation. The Dirac equation was, I think, I gamma mu d mu plus, or no, it was minus, I believe, m psi equals 0. So ignore for a moment the mass term, take a massless particle, and then you have a matrix. In the case of the Dirac equation, it was 4 by 4 times a derivative acting on the spinor. And here we have very similar thing, a 2 by 2 matrix multiplied with a derivative acting on the two-component spinor equals 0. So yeah, it's not so surprising that you find such a form for the 2 by 2 spinor equation when you've seen the Dirac equation before. Good. Then you could also do the same thing. I think I don't need a new board. Similar for phi L. Do the same exercise. I recommend to do it also as a homework to understand it better. Sigma r mu d mu phi r equals 0, and the matrices sigma r mu are very similar to the matrices sigma l mu, and it's 1 and plus instead of minus the Pauli matrices. So final result for today is this pair of equations, two equations for the two possibilities of the spinor, one for the left, one for the right-handed, not perfectly identical, but very similar. And yeah, what we don't manage anymore today is now to, I mean, this is an equation which is for a massless two-component spinor. There's no parameter reminding of the mass and so. And what we are going to do next time is we try to add a mass term. For example, write plus m times phi l, similar as in the Dirac equation. And then we will see that this thing is not anymore Poincaré invariant. But, and this is the point where we arrive at the Dirac equation, when we combine this equation and that equation, roughly speaking, a right and a left-handed spinor to a four-component Dirac spinor, then we are allowed to add a mass term and can retain Poincaré invariance. And this is basically the reason why the Dirac spinor has four components. It's nothing else than a left and a right-handed spinor, but it's necessary, as we'll see next time, to have a mass term. Final comment, this one here is the equation for neutrinos, for massless fermions, without interactions, free neutrinos in a certain sense, but it's also realized to some extent in nature. It's called also Weil-Gleichung, Weil-Equation. And I think since we had before, it's called Weil-Spinor. Okay. If there are no more questions, then let's continue on Tuesday.